If you think of pandas as typically quiet animals, you're right. But as you just heard, the new baby panda at the National Zoo has a lot to say when veterinarians were trying to give him his first checkup. Today, we're going to talk about that new panda and many of the other 2,000 animals at the National Zoo. From the alligators to the zebras, our guest today is responsible for every single one of them. Stephen Monfort is a veterinarian and wildlife conservationist who has been in charge of the National Zoo since 2018. We're also joined today by our class of the week, Ms. Prue's first graders at Gladys Noon Spellman Elementary School in Cheverly, Maryland. We're sure they have questions about animals, zookeeping, and conversation, but we think you might too. Adults, you're welcome to listen, but on Kojo for Kids, we take kids' calls only. Steve Monfort, thank you so much for joining us. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Kojo. It's great to be with you again.
Yes. Steve, I know many of our listeners are eager to hear about the baby panda, but first let's talk about you as a kid. Where were you born? Where did you grow up? And what did you like to do?
Well, Kojo, my father was a U.S. Marine, and so we moved around quite a bit. But I did. I grew up mostly in San Diego, California. One thing that is relevant, I think, to this conversation is that when I was 5 and 6 years old, we lived in the Philippines. And outside of my house, about 100 yards away, was a chain-link fence. And beyond that was the jungle. And there were macaques that would come out at night. And I would see rivers of bats flying across the sky. There were bugs as big as my little hand. And everywhere I looked, there were fascinating things that had to do ultimately with nature. And I think, truthfully, you know, that's probably when I absolutely fell in love with nature and wildlife and animals, just that curiosity, the power of weather systems to animals in the jungle. It was just really fascinating for me.
Did you have pets that you can tell us about?
Oh, sure. That was also, you know, at that age, around 6 years old, I think we got the first dog that I fell in love with. And it, her name was D-O-G, so not very clever, but dogs, phonetically spelled out. She was a German Shepherd. And there was just something about animals and the way one can communicate with an animal, sort of the unconditional love that a dog provides. You know, that really attracted me, you know, to want to be with animals and care for them and learn more about them.
You're serious. Your first pet's name was D-O-G?
Yeah, but we said it fast, so it was D-O-G.
What did you want to be when you grew up? Did you picture yourself working with animals?
No, you know, I'll be honest with you. I think when I was in grade school, I think we took one of those tests that told you what you were going to be when you grew up, and it didn't indicate a scientist or a veterinarian. But when I was in high school, that was really the time, maybe it was junior high, I started to dream about, you know, what sort of career could I pursue that would have a combination of my love of nature and animals. And, you know, at the time, I didn't articulate it this way, but wanting to be part of something important where I could make a difference and where I could be part of something bigger than myself. And that's where I kind of considered veterinary medicine as an opportunity to do that. And that became my goal at that time.
Steve, we've got a few callers already, but before I go to the phones, after college, you went to veterinary school. What do you learn there? I assume they teach you to care for cats and dogs, but what about caring for elephants, hippos, and other animals found in zoos?
That's a great question, Kojo. I went to UC Davis in California, and they had, at the third and fourth year, you got to specialize, and they had a track for zoo and wildlife medicine. So I took that track, and when I graduated, I came then to the Smithsonian. I did a summer internship at the zoo, never imagining I would be in Washington and one day be the director of the zoo. But, you know, my progression changed from wanting to be a veterinarian to falling in love with science and then combining the two together. And so I spent most of my real career at the Smithsonian being a research veterinarian. So I was both a scientist and a veterinarian.
You're the director of the National Zoo, but also the Smithsonian's Conservation Biology Institute. What is that?
Well, we have, we're, you know, the National Zoo. We take the name, you know, the nation's zoo. We We're part of the Smithsonian, and we feel very strongly that the mission of the Smithsonian relates to us quite well, which is the increase and diffusion of knowledge. And we know so little about the biology and the life history of species, millions of species, many of which have never even been named to science. And so, you know, it's a big job to understand that and to do it. We have a very strong group of scientists that work to help understand the biology of animals, not only their physiology, but let's say, how do we care for them, but also how do we help them be sustained in nature to stop them from going extinct. And so many of our scientists are based out at this 3,000-acre facility in Front Royal, Virginia, that's closed to the public, but where we do a lot of endangered species research and laboratory research, and where many of our scientists from both the zoo and SCBI deploy and work in 25 or 30 countries around the world, you know, each year, at least in a non-pandemic year.
I think Kaya, 9 years old in Laurel, Maryland, would like to stump you. Here is Kaya. Kaya, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Okay, I have a question. Do you know what a dole is?
I'm sorry, what was the name?
Dole.
A dole.
Dole? Yes, of course. A dole is an Asiatic wild dog, and they live in groups, but we know very little about their biology. So we have scientists that work in Thailand and other parts of Southeast Asia where these species exist. And it was what I mentioned before. We know their numbers are reducing in nature, but we don't necessarily know the causes. So a lot of our research is understanding just the basic biology of doles, how they move, how they live, what they eat, what their threats are, and things like that. So I do know what they are. They're a magnificent small canid species, and we're working hard to help save them right now.
Kaya, how did you find out about doles?
My favorite nature TV show had an episode about doles, but the first time I found out about them was when I had this book about animals. So I was randomly flipping through the pages, and then I saw one about the dole.
Oh, well, good for you, and thank you for calling about doles, because you have helped to educate a lot of people, you and Steve Montfort. Thank you very much for your call. Well, Steve, I don't think we can put off talking about the panda any longer. This baby was born on August 21st, which makes him about 8 weeks old. What can you tell us about him?
Well, he's our COVID miracle, I would say. And this is because, well, any panda birth is something to celebrate, sparks great joy in millions of people. But mom, in this case, Meishong, is quite old for a panda. So, and we looked at all of the charts of animals around the world that had given birth, all of the pandas that had given birth. And she, only one older female than Meishong, she was 22, she had ever given birth before successfully. So our expectations were very low. And so when she showed all the normal behaviors in the spring and all the signals indicated she was receptive to breeding, we decided to go ahead and did the insemination procedure, and she gave birth. So our expectations were low, but now we have this fantastic, beautiful little male cub who just opened his eyes a couple days ago, growing. I saw him just the other day. He's almost as wide as he is long. He is so well nourished, and he does nothing but eat and sleep and cuddle up with mom. It's unbelievably amazing how quickly these little guys grow from something the size of a butter stick now to, we estimated he's increased his body size at least 6 times from the time he was born, which is incredible in 2 months.
Well, these days, the panda is undeniably cute, but his newborn pictures show a skinny, hairless baby, just a few inches long. Why do pandas not look much like pandas when they're born?
Well, it's a great question. They're born basically helpless to their mom, and they rely on mom 100%. They can't maintain their body heat very well, so they have to stay snuggled up with mom. Of course, they need milk and so on. We don't know a lot about pandas, exactly why they're born in this state, but we know that similar to other bears, they're born at a very immature stage, and we think this has to do with there's less energy required by mom to carry a very small fetus or a baby inside of her. And that saves mom energy, and she can save that up to produce milk that the baby needs when it's born. So it's a strategy that's worked, of course, over hundreds of thousands of years for pandas. And mom certainly knew, she knows exactly what to do. The second that baby was born, she took those big hands that are the size of baseball mitts and just reached down and scooped that little cub up and put it on her chest. I mean, it was something to behold.
Well, here is a question from 5-year-old Nora in Washington, D.C. Nora, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Why do pandas eat bamboo?
Why do pandas eat bamboo? Yes.
Yeah, that's another great question,
Nora.
Yes, it's one of the mysteries. We don't really know exactly why pandas depend on bamboo, but they certainly do, and it's almost the exclusive part of their diet. When they live in China, they live in the mountains, and they live in bamboo forest, and they rely on certain types of bamboo species in order for them to survive. It is a mystery to us. Pandas, they're a bear, but they're not like many of the other bear species because, as we know, the big ferocious bears, the grizzly bears and the polar bears, they're very much meat eaters. They're carnivores, where giant pandas are almost exclusively herbivore in their diet. So it's a great question. It's one that science doesn't really know the answer to, but it's something that we do know that they must have bamboo. And boy, they eat a lot of bamboo. I hate to say it. They eat many, many pounds of bamboo, and most of it comes out as their poo looks just like bamboo does. It's really funny to see. It's almost like they can't digest it very well, so they have to eat a tremendous amount of it to get the energy they need. So pandas are very interesting in that way.
But I got to tell you, Nora, that's a great question, because watching pandas, they make bamboo actually seem appetizing, okay? Tempts me to go out and eat some bamboo. Here is 6.5-year-old Owen in Cheverly, Maryland. Owen, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Mine is, how do baby pandas grow? How do baby pandas sleep?
Oh, my. I think little baby pandas and grown-up pandas, they have to be experts at sleeping, because they sleep a lot of the time. They're either eating or they're sleeping, and the little cub is no different. The cub needs mom's milk in order for it to grow. And so the main source, the only source of food right now, is mother's milk. And so the cub drinks that milk a lot of different times during the day, and it converts that into its own body fat and the energy it needs to grow. So right now it's eating just milk, no bamboo for the baby. And when it gets older, it'll eventually learn how to do that. But it will be with mom. They continue to nurse off and on until around 2 years of age. So the cub won't, when the wild, wouldn't be fully weaned, wouldn't stop taking mom's milk until around 2 years of age. So the milk is the main part of nutrition right now. And then over time, it will gradually start to eat bamboo. And then pretty soon, it'll be just bamboo after about 2 years.
Owen, thank you very much for your call. Owen called from Cheverly, so he's probably a part of our class of the week. Miss Bruce, first graders is Gladys Noon Spellman Elementary School in Cheverly, Maryland. Let's go next to 8-year-old Violet in Woodbridge, Virginia. Violet, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hi, I have a question, please.
I know you do, Violet. Go ahead and ask it.
My favorite animal is a chicken. What do they eat?
A chicken. Oh, chickens. Chickens are like to eat a lot of, barnyard chickens will eat a lot of things, but they like grain mostly. So they're pretty much vegetarian, and they'll eat seeds and grain and things like that. So they're very healthy, have a very healthy diet, actually.
Thank you very much for your call here. What does the panda have a name yet? Who's going to name him?
We are going to have an ability for everyone to vote on a name. So we're getting some names together now. We're reaching out to some of our good colleagues in China who work with us, and we're putting together a list of maybe probably four names. And then we're going to ask the public to vote, and we're going to then unveil the name at a ceremony. We haven't picked the date of that yet, but it's upcoming.
I have a suggestion.
There are many suggestions, Kojo. You can only imagine.
How about DOG?
But here, yeah, that would be, it worked for me.
Here I'd is like that. Here is 6-year-old Lori in Bowie, Maryland. Lori, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Have you ever seen a toucan in the wild?
I think I have only once, but boy, they're really beautiful birds. There's so many beautiful birds, even in your backyard, especially during the spring and the summer. If you pay attention early in the springtime and you start listening for the birds to make sounds, many of these birds fly from thousands and thousands of miles away, including South America, and they come all the way up to your backyard, and you'll start to hear them singing. So these birds that live in South America, many species, not the toucan necessarily, but many species of birds, they might live here for part of their life, but they live somewhere far, far away for the rest of their life. And we try to figure out how do amazing migrations like that, how do they work and why are they important and how can we make sure they keep, we have the ability for animals to move without humans interfering with that in the future. So birds are, I like that you like birds because they are incredibly beautiful and there's billions of birds and they're all around us and they provide just such a great gift to us. So just go outside. That's my main message to young kids, really, is explore. Go outside. We live in a forest in our area. There's so much to see, so much wildlife there all year round, really, but especially in the springtime.
Lori, thank you very much for your call. This question for me, Steve, is very uncomfortable. This baby panda is a boy. How did we figure that out?
Well,
was there any touching involved?
Well, let me just say, there is, normally speaking, you can lift the tail and you can see whether it's a male or a female. But okay. When they're that tiny, when they're just like the size of a butter stick, it's possible to make a mistake. And so to be absolutely sure, we took a little swab and a little bit of some cells from the mouth, just swabbed some cells, and we sent them to our genetics lab, and they did a special test that confirmed the sex. And so we absolutely know for sure that it's a male. Yeah.
Oh, good. Thank you for
the swab. Don't want to make any mistakes in that department.
Thank you for the swab. Will he eventually go to live in China like the other pandas born at the National Zoo? And why do we keep sending pandas born here to China?
Well, you know, we have a fantastic 50-year-long partnership with our Chinese colleagues. And so the pandas, the adult pandas, are really owned by China. And what they do is they loan them to us. And so while they're here, if they have any babies, then by the time the babies are 4 years of age, we have to send them back to China, or we send them to China for their first time, and they join in the breeding program there. Because as you can imagine, most of the pandas that exist in the world live in China. And so they have a program there to try to breed pandas so that they can ultimately put animals back into the wild to reintroduce them. So the young cubs that we produce will all go back and contribute to the breeding of the population in China, and we hope that one day their offspring will be free living in nature once again.
Here is 7-year-old Lucas from our elementary school in Cheverly, Maryland. Lucas, you're on the air. Go ahead, please, ask your question.
How do you take care of animals?
Oh, that's a great question. You know, when you're your age, when I was your age, I think I mentioned to Kojo already, I mean, the way that I learned to take care of animals was that I had a pet. And in my case, it was a dog. Later on, though, when I was in sixth grade, I had a special teacher, Mrs. Brereton, and she became someone who helped me understand about nature. And so we went on walks, and she would let us catch some bugs, and she had a snake in the classroom. And we would put them in little tanks and terrariums. We would watch them and observe them, and we would feed them, and we learned how to care for them. And so for me, learning about caring for animals was something that I was guided. Somebody showed me or encouraged me, you know, to get out into nature, get your hands dirty, pick up bugs. You know, if you find a salamander, it's okay to look at it and get close to it. And maybe you have a pet, and it can be a tiny pet. It could be a gerbil. It could be a bird. It could be a dog. But it's somebody. It's an animal will give you a sense of responsibility for caring for it because it depends on you. So that's learned that way in the beginning, and I fell in love with animals in that way too.
Thank you very much for your call. We only have about 30 seconds left, but Cora in Washington, D.C. has a very important question. Cora, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hi. Do you have a favorite animal, not like a species, but a favorite animal in particular?
Oh, my. I, you know, if you're the director of a zoo, it's kind of, you have to love all of the animals. It's like being a mom or a dad. And so I try not to play favorites to individual animals. But I have to say, I've had a couple of animals that I took care of as a veterinarian in the past that meant a lot to me. And you have to know that the animal caretakers at the zoo, when something bad happens to an animal, they feel terrible, like a family member going wrong. So we do care deeply for the animals we have. I just want to quickly say, one way you could learn about taking care of animals, we've just come up with a new game. It's called Zoo Guardians, and you can pick it up free.
Got about
free
20 seconds.
Yeah. Anyway, it's a game that teaches you how to build your own zoo and how to care for your own animals. So check it out. It's called Zoo Guardians.
Cora, I know he's partial to the naked mole rat. Steve Montford is the director of the Smithsonian's National Zoo and Conservation Biology Institute. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Thanks, Kojo.
Kojo for Kids was produced by Lauren Marco. Parents and teachers, if you'd like your class to be featured on Kojo for Kids, go to kojoshow.org/kids. We're looking for elementary, middle, and high school classes for our upcoming shows. Our conversation about Deaf You was produced by Julie Dippenbrock with help on the Facebook live stream from Chris Chester and Yanlin Zhang. Coming up tomorrow, the election is about 2 weeks away, so how is early voting going and what issues are driving voters to the polls? Plus, Virginia has gone from purple to blue the past few elections. We'll talk with the chair of the state's Republican and Democratic parties about politics in the Commonwealth, the divided electorate, and what color Virginia will be on November 3rd. And I'd like to mention last week on the show, Washington Teachers Union President Liz Davis shared her concerns with returning to in-person instruction. On Wednesday, we'll talk with DC Public Schools Chancellor Louis Farabee. That all starts tomorrow at noon. Until then, thank you for listening and stay safe. I'm Kojo Nnamdi.
The Kojo Nnamdi Show is produced by Julie Deppenbrock, Sydney Grannon, Kurt Gardiner, Lauren Marco, Richard Cunningham, and Inez Renike. Our managing producer is Ingalisa Schroepstorf. Our engineer is Mike Kidd. For past shows and more content, visit kojoshow.org.
WAMU 88.5 is your listener-supported NPR news station in the greater Washington, D.C. region. You can support the Kojo Nnamdi Show and all the regional coverage you value by becoming a member today. Click the donate button at WAMU.org, and thanks.